Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now we continue our presidential election series, 30 Issues in 30 Days. Let others focus only on the horse race. We're exploring an issue a show for 30 shows between now and the election. You can see our 30 Issues gallery at WNYC.org/issues. Today, issue number 6, free trade. Are both parties outsourcing our future? Now, free trade in theory means no tariffs for goods and services sold between countries. In theory, this is supposed to create good jobs in this country by allowing us to export things more easily. But critics say it mostly allows American companies like GM or GE, say, to outsource manufacturing, hire cheap workers in the developing world, make things where labor and environmental standards are low, then import the goods back here, same American brands, fewer American jobs. Both parties embrace free trade agreements with many countries. They also say they'll get tough on countries that subsidize their own products to give them an unfair advantage against ours. Here's President Obama in 2010 touting a big free trade agreement with South Korea.
This deal is a win for American workers, for our farmers and ranchers. It will increase exports of American agricultural products. From aerospace to electronics, it will increase our manufacturing exports to Korea, which already supports some 200,000 American jobs and many small businesses. In particular, manufacturers of American cars and trucks will have much more access to the Korean market. We'll encourage the development of electric cars and green technology in the United States, and we'll continue to ensure a level playing field for American automakers here at home.
President Obama in 2010. There is also the other side of free trade, cracking down on those countries that don't practice it. Here is Mitt Romney from one of the Republican primary debates talking about what he would do as president with respect to China.
Well, number one on day one is acknowledging something which everyone knows. They're a currency manipulator. And on that basis, we also go before the WTO and bring an action against them as a currency manipulator. And that allows us to apply selectively tariffs where we believe they are stealing our intellectual property, hacking into our computers, or artificially lowering their prices and killing American jobs. We can't just sit back and let China run all over us. People say, well, you'll start a trade war. There's one going on right now, folks. They're stealing our jobs, and we're going to stand up to China.
Mitt Romney. President Obama pushes back, by the way. Just last week, campaigning to Ohio auto workers, he announced an unfair trade practices suit against China at the World Trade Organization over government subsidies to Chinese cars and auto parts, and he used the occasion to Romney bash.
But he's been running around Ohio claiming he's going to roll up his sleeves and he's going to take the fight to China. Here's the thing. His experience has been owning companies that were called pioneers in the business of outsourcing jobs to countries like China. He made money investing in companies that uprooted from here and went to China. Pioneers. Now, how you can't stand up to China when all you've done is sent them our jobs? You can talk a good game, but I like to walk the walk, not just talk the talk.
President Obama just last week. So you get the outlines of how the two candidates are using this issue on the stump. Our first guest on this was there for a very important piece of free trade history. Will Marshall was an advisor to President Bill Clinton when the Democrats really first decided to embrace free trade, a big political change at that time in the 90s. Will Marshall is president and founder of the Progressive Policy Institute, the think tank that was associated with the Democratic Leadership Council, the centrist Democrats organization. Will, thanks so much for doing this, and welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian.
Can you tell us the history as you recall it? What was new for President Clinton as a Democrat in the 90s, and why did he embrace free trade when other Democrats had mostly scoffed at it as abandoning workers to curry favor with the fat cats?
Well, let me first maybe quibble with the premise a little bit of that. Keep in mind that the presidential wing of the party and the congressional wing are always different. That is, protectionist sentiment, anti-trade sentiment is always centered in the Congress. It represents local districts where plants shutter and jobs do go overseas. But presidents have a different responsibility. They've got to look at the overall economic impact of trade on the macro economy.
And let me jump in on that for a second, because you're saying if Democrats in the 80s had the reputation of being anti-free trade, it's because that populism came up from the Congress, which they controlled, while President Reagan and the first President Bush were the presidents?
Yeah, because, you know, the trade tradition stretches back to Roosevelt, really. Roosevelt broke with the isolationist and protectionist policies of the Republican Party. He and Harry Truman were huge free traders. The whole world trading regime, the GATT, you know, general tariff and trade regime, began back under them. And so, if anything, Democrats are the architects of the post-war rules-based trading regime. But I think the reason that people may have the impression that Clinton did something new was because it was exactly what you said, that in the 80s, the Republicans had the White House, and congressional Democrats were skeptical of trade-expanding agreements. And they were skeptical of them when Bill Clinton came in 92.
But is it entirely a false premise to say Clinton changed and embraced something? I had a caller just yesterday when we were doing issue number 5 in this series, which was the fate of the labor movement, and a liberal Democrat caller said, you know, this all goes back to Clinton in the 90s when he embraced free trade and sold the unions down the river. I mean, I know you'll argue with selling the unions down the river, but didn't you guys at that time make some kind of strategic decision that the Democrats had been on the wrong side of history?
No, I don't think it was a strategic decision. Look, we had the Kennedy round in 1962. Lyndon Johnson, as president, supported trade expansion. So did Jimmy Carter. So my point is that Democratic presidents were right mm-hmm. in this post-war tradition of trade liberalization and expansion. And it was really in Congress where you saw protectionist sentiments rise, particularly in the 80s as Japan rose. Remember the rising sun? Japan was going to eclipse the U.S.
Yeah,
economy.
For 10 minutes, we thought Japan was going to be the economic power of forever, right?
That's right. But look, what Clinton did, and I think this goes to your point, as Clinton picked up, he inherited the NAFTA agreement, right? That had been really negotiated by his predecessors, Reagan and Bush. And he inherited it, and he had to make a decision. You know, was he going to scuttle this very large North American free trade agreement, you know, painstakingly negotiated with our closest neighbors mm-hmm. and, by the way, biggest trading partners, or not? And so I think, you know, because labor had set its face against the NAFTA agreement, you know, had drawn a line around it. Not only labor, remember Ross Perot, the other wild card candidate in 92, talked to us about the great sucking sound.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I want to actually play about 30 seconds of that historical audio. You remember, some of our listeners will remember, the big televised debate between Vice President Gore and Ross Perot.
Right.
Gore defending free trade as good for the future of jobs, Perot and his giant sucking sound. And this whole thing was remarkable for the role reversal. There was, the Democratic politician who had come out of the Congress embracing free trade versus the wealthy industrialist who feared the impact on jobs. And here's about 30 seconds of Ross Perot from the 1992 presidential debate, where he got to be in the room with George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton.
We have got to stop sending jobs overseas. To those of you in the audience who are business people, pretty simple. If you're paying $12, $13, $14 an hour for factory workers, and you can move your factory south of the border, pay a dollar an hour for labor, hire a young 25, that's assume you've been in business for a long time, you've got a mature workforce. Pay a dollar an hour for your labor, have no health care, that's the most expensive single element making a car, have no environmental controls, no pollution controls, and no retirement, and you don't care about anything but making money, there will be a giant sucking sound going south.
You know, listening to that clip for the first time in many years, that may have only been 1992, but somehow he had the sound of an old newsreel from the 1920s.
I remember that debate. That was when the vice president gave Perot the Smoot-Hawley Award after the Republican sponsors of the great protectionist measure that helped deepen the Depression. But look, I mean, maybe we can move on. I'm pretty, you know, my history tells me very clearly that the Democratic Party, in fact, was the free trade party and
sure.
created the whole post-war rules-based global trading system.
And I do want to move on and get your thoughts on how much Perot was right at the time.
Yeah. I think that's the issue. And you look, in the 90s, when Bill Clinton was very, you know, aggressive, it wasn't just NAFTA, it was a whole raft of very important trade agreements, including China accession to WTO and the first IT trade agreements. You know, there was a whole raft of pro-trade, trade-liberalizing initiatives that Clinton got behind. And look, from 1996 to 2000, the American economy stood up on its haunches and roared. We had tremendous job growth. And we had, you know, the unemployment rate was down to about 4%, which most economists consider about full employment. And more than that, it was good job growth. If you look at the income distribution tables, which a wonk like me does this kind of thing, for those late 90s years, you saw that all groups across the, you know, the socioeconomic ladder, all groups advanced. It was what we call the picket fence distribution, where there's roughly equal gains to all groups, not this kind of concentration of the wealth in the top, 20% or 5% or 1% that we've seen really since 2000. So in the 90s, the free trade equation was working. The United States was losing low-end manufacturing jobs and gaining all kinds of high-end information technology, communication sectors, internet, software creation sorts of jobs. And we were growing richer. We had robust job creation and a good distribution of wealth. All that started to change really around 2000 with the first dot-com bubble and then the policies that followed. And we saw the great American job machine sputter. Even before the meltdown in 2007, 2008, the recession and then the financial crunch, we saw job creation really slow down dramatically. And so that's what's changed. You know, we are no longer reaping the benefits of good job
right.
creation.
But that's
that's what's gotten people to pay, you know, to question whether globalization and trade have not taken a larger toll on our economy than we ever thought.
Well, is it possible to get more specific than that? Like, what industries and workers would you say have been net winners and losers after 20 years of post-NAFTA free trade? For example, the agreements Congress passed last year with South Korea, Colombia, and Panama, the South Korea one in particular that we heard President Obama touting a minute ago, was expected to be good for American meat and dairy exports, chemicals and plastics exports, and also the U.S. financial services industry. Wall Street always wins, but bad for things like steel, textiles, machine parts, and semiconductors.
Right.
Is that consistent with who the winners and losers have tended to be over the long run?
Well, yeah. What has lost is manufacturing. It's taken a bigger hit. In fact, our work at PPI has shown that we've actually suffered more from offshoring and globalization in the manufacturing sector than the official statistics reveal. That is, the job losses and the hollowing out of middle-income, middle-skill, middle-wage kind of jobs has been worse than we think. This phenomenon has gotten worse since 2000. So our views have changed as the empirical reality that we're looking at has changed. On the other hand, there are winners. I mean, the last year, the agricultural sector racked up its greatest export numbers ever, and we're doing quite well in services. You know, United States remains the number one exporter in the world, But what's happened is that we've become an unbalanced economy. We've taken too big a hit in the manufacturing sector, and I mean by that manufacturing employment. Manufacturing output is actually held roughly steady as a percentage of GDP, but it's employment. And so you have
how much of that
out of middle-class jobs.
How much of that do you think is the result of free trade agreements?
Well, it's not just free trade agreements. It's technological change. It's offshoring, and it's global financial flows, and investment. So it's all of this complex of things, including importantly technological shifts, that we put under the general rubric of globalization. And again, we think it's taken a much bigger toll on the manufacturing sector than we've even measured.
But is there something
we should accept?
And I understand that it's multifactorial. But if free trade agreements are a contributing factor, our next guest, for example, Alan Tonelson, who's with a think tank that represents small manufacturers and medium-sized manufacturers in this country, he would have the U.S. suspend our obligations under NAFTA and the World Trade Organization temporarily while unemployment remains so high, so government can buy American-made goods as a matter of policy from government contractors, which is currently prohibited under those agreements. What do you think of something like that?
Well, I don't think it makes much sense. Alan and I are friends. We've debated this issue for longer than I care to admit. But here's what I do think. Free traders like me, our views have changed. We think offshoring and globalization have taken a bigger toll. So we're asking different questions. We're asking, how can we insource? How can we claw back some of the lost manufacturing jobs? How can we create more manufacturing employment in this country? We just put out a report not long ago saying that, asking the question, what would it take to wipe out the America's trade deficit in goods, which is really the source of our big trade deficits? And we came up with a figure of 4 million. If we were able to create 4 million manufacturing jobs in the United States, we would wipe out that goods deficit. We think that this is, we're not sure how possible this is, but unlike some folks, we haven't given up on seeing manufacturing employment grow. And we think that there are sets of policies that can help us, have more manufacturing jobs in this country.
What do you think would be key policies there? If, people are listening and thinking, they're going to be able to compete with China for making iPads and compete with Mexico for making American brand cars.
Yeah. Well, the keys are investment, investment, investment. That is, we have to invest more in this country. In we got to see this $2 trillion worth of retained profits that U.S. corporations are sitting on, plowed into the American productive base. We've got to invest. We've got to modernize our infrastructure because we're not going to attract investment, domestic or foreign, if we've got second-rate, third-rate infrastructure, which we have. And we've got to invest more in closing the skills gaps to make sure we have enough technically equipped workers or adept workers to all too often there are labor shortages that sometimes drive U.S. manufacturers overseas, not just the quest for cheap labor costs. And we think if you invest in the things that are going to create more domestic manufacturing jobs, at the same time there's some positive trends happening in China. Their labor costs are rising. Transportation and energy costs are rising. So some of their comparative advantages that were driven, largely but not exclusively by cheap labor are disappearing. We're already seeing them lose production to even lower wage countries, Vietnam and others.
Why won't that race to the bottom just continue?
Well, it will from China's point of view, but there's an opportunity for the United States to capture particularly high-end manufacturing and to make sure, and this is the strategic imperative, that we hold on to the know-how, when we're offshoring production, that we don't also offshore the know-how. And the great example there is Apple. Yes, Apple makes all of its iPhones and its iPads in China and elsewhere, but the intellectual content, the real value of those products is still developed In the United States, and that's what we've got to. That's what we've got to make sure we do not lose, even as we do look for opportunities to, as we put it, to have what we call import recapture, to win back market share for things like. And look, it's happening. I think we're going to see it in autos. We've already seen it in steel. We've seen it in some of the batteries, advanced batteries, although. That's a complicated picture, but
you think that's starting to happen. So
yeah,
coming from
and companies are starting to brag about bringing jobs back. That's a good thing.
So before you go, coming from a Democratic Party related think tank, do you see Mitt Romney and Barack Obama as being very different on these issues, or is this just something that the market is doing?
I don't think that they're all that different, to be honest with you. If you look at the platforms of the two parties, they're not terribly different. Your clips encapsulated, the tactical, ploys of both sides. Romney wants to say Obama's had what he calls a virtual surrender, to China in on trade policy, not cracking down on their mercantilist and industrial policies. Obama wants to say, how can that outsourcer accuse us of anything? But by and large, and this takes us back to the beginning of our conversation, I'm sorry, but presidents have to defend the national economic interest. That's why presidents of both parties generally, name a protectionist president in the last 40 years. I don't think you can really do it. When you get elected president, suddenly you can't. Remember, Obama in 2008 and running for president was very tough. He was going to renegotiate NAFTA. But, he got into office and quickly dropped that idea, which is a really bad one. Canada and Mexico are not enemies or adversaries. They're our biggest trading partners and closest neighbors. They certainly wouldn't welcome a total upending of the NAFTA trading relationships that have blossomed since 94. So, you say one thing on the stump when you're a candidate, and when you win and you come into the White House, you have to protect the nation's overall interests.
What?
But even free traders like us, just to close, want to say that, we were looking at the advantages from low prices and low inflation, right, from trade in the late 90s, because the American economy was generating lots of great jobs. The American economy is no longer generating those great jobs, so we're willing to make the trade-off. We're willing to see prices rise in this country, quit chasing the low-cost goods as much as we normally do, in order to see good job creation expanded in the United States.
One little addendum, if I might. Some people say free trade agreements are not only good for both countries' economies, but they actually help prevent wars because countries don't tend to go to war against countries they're doing a lot of business with. Do you think experience bears that out, or is it still a hypothesis?
Well, too many counterexamples going back to World War One, where we had the world's leading trading partners kind of got into war. On the other hand, if you look at the U.S.-China relationship, is one of economic codependence that I am positive puts real constraints on, on how far anybody can push. I will wager a bet that Mr. Romney, if he wins, which I think is highly unlikely, but if he wins, he's not going to come in and on day one pick a trade fight with with this massive trading partner that holds over $1 trillion of U.S. Treasury bonds, our biggest lender and creditor. There's just too much at stake for both economies. So that interdependence constrains the domestic political pressures that push us toward a trade war, in my view.
Will Marshall, president and founder of the Progressive Policy Institute. Thank you so much for having this really interesting conversation.
Thank you, Brian. My pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we're going to get a more skeptical view next from Alan Tonelson, author of the book Race to the Bottom. He proposes that the U.S. suspend its obligations under some of the free trade agreements while the jobs crisis continues. Stay with us.
We're going to have trade that works for America. I want to promote trade. I want to open up new markets for American goods. We can do a lot more in Latin America and other parts of the world. And we also need to crack down on nations that cheat and don't play by the rules.
It's our presidential election series, 30 issues in 30 days. See all 30 at WNYC.org/issues. We posted questions for all 30, so you can get the conversations going in advance of their radio days, WNYC.org/issues, and see the 30 issues graphics from our data news team, like the one that went up yesterday showing the rise and fall of strikes as a tool for American labor, all at WNYC.org/issues. We continue now with issue 6. Are both parties outsourcing America's future? With us next is Alan Tonelson, a research fellow at the United States Business and Industry Council, which represents about 2,000 mostly small and medium-sized domestic manufacturers. He is author of Race to the Bottom: Why a Global Worker Surplus and Uncontrolled Free Trade Are Sinking American Living Standards. Alan, welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. It's great to be here.
And I want to get to right to some of the things that you propose that I brought up with Will Marshall in the last segment. For example, suspending our obligations under NAFTA and the World Trade Organization while unemployment remains so high?
Sure, and that's only one of the steps that that we need to take. But regarding that step specifically, for more than 50 years, in fact, probably going back about 75 years, there have been a Buy American provisions that have governed U.S. government procurement of goods and services. There are exceptions to this, but that's generally been the policy. The main exceptions have concerned goods that are simply not available here or that are not available at a reasonable price. The problem, though, is that the greatest loophole has been the fact that we are not allowed legally to discriminate against foreign goods from countries that have signed a World Trade Organization deal that supposedly is opening government procurement markets all over the world, so that, again, allegedly gives U.S. producers and U.S. exporters just as much access to foreign government markets as foreign producers and foreign exporters have to U.S. government markets. Like most free trade deals, that deal has been a miserable flop, but the legalistic United States still scrupulously abides by it. That's got to come to an end. Because especially during a period of if not actual economic crisis anymore, something awfully close to it, it should be axiomatic that U.S. taxpayer dollars, wherever possible, go to purchasing U.S.-made goods and U.S.-provided services so that this money stays in the U.S. economy to create wealth in the U.S. economy.
But you heard Will Marshall say that presidents of both parties, going all the way back to Roosevelt, have protected what they see as the U.S. trade imperative, and that is expanding free trade, because ultimately it's better for economic growth than going down the road that you were just outlining, where if the United States started to say, oh, okay, we're going to have special preferences in our federal contracting for buying U.S.-made products, then China's going to do it, then Brazil's going to do it, and on down the road, and everything's going to eventually close up.
Okay, let me make three quick rejoinders here. First, from 1945 to roughly 1980, it was easy as pie for the United States. In fact, it was a no-brainer for the United States to follow these standard trade liberalization policies. Why? Because for most of those decades, the rest of the world, i.e., our main foreign competitors, were still recovering from the effects of World War II. So literally, the rest of the world economy for most of that period was in shambles, or else slowly, you know, in some cases rapidly, but steadily building. When you have situations like that, it always pays off for the country whose economic and manufacturing base has remained virtually untouched to pursue free trade policy. So the free trade policies were much less important than the fact that we had such an enormous built-in advantage for so long. Rejoinder number two, one of the most protectionist presidents of the last 100 years was Ronald Reagan, because Ronald Reagan provided trade relief to five major American industries that were under foreign assault in the 1980s, including semiconductors, including machine tools, including steel. There were either tariffs imposed on foreign products coming in, or those tariffs were very credibly threatened. And guess what? All of those industries experienced very significant competitive rebounds. The third rejoinder that I would make is precisely because we have continued mindlessly to pursue these free trade policies as if nothing else in the rest of the world had changed since those early post-World War II decades. We hollowed out the U.S. manufacturing sector, and we forced our economy to become ever more dependent, not on creating real wealth, but on reckless spending and reckless borrowing. And guess what? We saw how that story ended in the fall of 2008, when the entire world economy, including ours, nearly collapsed.
And what was interesting, one thing that was interesting to me in the conversation with Will Marshall, is that he acknowledged that free trade seems to have contributed to manufacturing fleeing the United States in the last 20 years more than they hoped it would. But he said the keys to bringing it back, to re-importing these jobs, as I think he called it, are mostly through investment, investing in training, investing in infrastructure to make sure that the U.S. has, you know, the intellectual capital to remain competitive.
And Will is certainly not the only policy advocate to insist that the very best responses to these global changes are purely domestic policy initiatives. The problem is that folks like this don't recognize that the inevitable effects in particular, the trade agreements that the United States has been signing for the last roughly 20 years, starting with NAFTA, which went into effect in 1994. That was 1993, I'm sorry. But the inevitable effects of these trade agreements has been to rig world markets and to restructure the world economy in ways that ensure that these purely domestic initiatives can't possibly work. And the reason is most of their likely benefits are going to leak overseas. And I'll give you just one quick example. If you wind up somehow greatly improving the quality of American primary and secondary education, which would presumably ensure that U.S. workers have the skills and knowledge they need to compete for the so-called jobs of the future, that still doesn't solve the problem created by the fact that every other country on this planet is engaged in the same re-education, reskilling, and retooling process. And by the way, for students and workers from very low-income countries, they can wind up being equally qualified with U.S. workers, but still earning orders of magnitude less.
Right. So here is President Obama speaking in April of this year in support of the free trade agreement that the U.S. signed and Congress passed on his watch with Colombia. And keeping in mind that your book is called Race to the Bottom, Why a Global Worker Surplus and Uncontrolled Free Trade Are Sinking American Living Standards, he seemed to respond to, if not your book title, at least this idea. Listen.
You know, the free trade agreement that we've negotiated between Colombia and the United States is an example of a free trade agreement that benefits both sides. It's a win-win. It has high standards.
–
It's a high standards agreement. It's not a race to the bottom, but rather it says each country is abiding by everything from strong rules around labor and the environment to intellectual property protection. And so I have confidence that as we implement this plan, what we're going to see is extraordinary opportunities for both U.S. and Colombian businesses.
President Obama at the Summit of the Americas this year. And Alan, the piece of that that I want to pick up on for this moment is where he talked about the labor and environmental standards, because this is another thing that opponents of free trade agreements argue, not just that it'll draw U.S. jobs into other countries, but that it would be a race to the bottom with respect to standards, and countries that had lax environmental laws would draw more manufacturers because they wouldn't have to deal with our environmental laws. He says it's not. He says free trade agreements, because the U.S., and I think he would say especially Democratic presidents, have been keen on negotiating labor and environmental standards into these agreements, have actually raised those standards in the developing world. Do you have an opinion about that?
There are two problems with this viewpoint, two specific ones that reflect not only common sense, but everything we've learned about signing trade deals and monitoring trade deals with what have by and large been very low-income countries, going back to NAFTA, which, as I recall now, was actually put into effect at the very beginning of 1994. But the two problems are, first of all, the U.S. government completely lacks any meaningful ability to enforce the labor and environmental provisions that have now, to a greater extent, been included in new trade agreements. And let's basically forget about Colombia specifically, because economically speaking, it's just peanuts. Let's think about the challenge of monitoring such trade deals with Brazil or India or China. How many zillion American bureaucrats would you have to have running around immense countries like these with their vast manufacturing complexes to make sure that the terms of these, you know, deals are being scrupulously abided by? And the obvious answer is it's an impossible challenge. The second problem with the president's perspective has to do with the fact that the main problems that result for the U.S. economy and for its highest value sectors from these new trade deals has to do with the fact that these deals, by and large, do nothing to stop the kinds of foreign subsidies that give foreign-based manufacturers, including foreign-based manufacturers that may be owned by U.S. companies, that give these foreign-based manufacturers major advantages over their U.S. counterparts, again, in high-value sectors, in advanced manufacturing particularly. And the main reason that these trade deals can do nothing about subsidies like this is because most of our trade competitors, for all of their virtues, don't write things down. In their own governing processes, they simply don't take nearly as seriously as we do concepts like transparency and like accountability. Mm-hmm. They tend to be run by secretive bureaucracies, and it's very difficult to know what those subsidies even are.
So in our last minute, since we're doing this in the context of our presidential election series, Do you see a difference between Romney and Obama on these issues? Will Marshall surprised me a little bit, coming out of a partisan think tank that is associated with the Democratic Party. He said no, the presidential imperative that has gone back for, you know, 70 years, as he describes it, where presidents promote free trade and Congress sometimes argues against it, means that Obama and Romney are actually going to be pretty similar on this, regardless of who's elected. Do you agree?
I think Will is right with one big exception, and that exception, of course, regards China. There's no question that Governor Romney has been proposing a much more aggressive and, I would argue, much smarter approach toward China than President Obama has been following. Having said that, I think where the two candidates, where they really overlap the most and the most importantly, is in their common assumption that there is a world full of economic opportunity out there for U.S. manufacturers, U.S. farmers, i.e. for prospective and actual U.S. exporters, if only we figured out how to negotiate these new trade deals right. And what I would urge them, and in particular, I would urge, you know, Governor Romney, who seems, you know, to understand this so far in the China context, what I would urge him to start recognizing is that the conditions that are present in China that make it such an impossible country to trade with on a mutually beneficial basis are present to varying degrees all over the world, in Japan, in Germany, in South Korea, Brazil, etc. And both candidates have to recognize that the biggest target of opportunity for U.S. manufacturers and other U.S. producers is the U.S. market at home that has been lost to import competition going back 20 years.
All right.
It is a market that is worth hundreds of billions of dollars of new orders.
Alan Tonelson, research fellow at the United States Business and Industry Council, which represents about 2,000 mostly small and medium-sized domestic manufacturers. He is author of Race to the Bottom, Why a Global Worker Surplus and Uncontrolled Free Trade Are Sinking American Living Standards. Thank you very much.
You're quite welcome, Brian. Thank you.
And that's it for today's edition of our presidential election series, 30 Issues in 30 Days. See all 30 at wnyc.org/issues. We've posted questions for all 30, so you can get the conversations going in advance of their radio days, wnyc.org/issues. Also, you can read some great articles related to today's and this week's issues on our site, thanks to longform.org. And don't forget, the WNYC Data News Team is posting interactive graphics and other tools that are really visually cool to illuminate the issues, all at wnyc.org/issues.